here. Okay. Very good. Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahaviryan Karavavahai Tejasvinavadhi Tamastu Ma Vidvishavahai Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Chaitanyam Sarvagam Sarvam Sarvabhuta Guhashayam Yat Sarva Vishayatitam Tasmai Sarva Vede Namaha. Oh my, very good. Welcome to you all. Welcome also to the many students attending this class regularly online. We continue with our study of this wonderful chapter 18 of Upadesha Sahasri. And let me get this going. Our next verse, just so I don't get interrupted. I need that. I need this. I thought that would happen, so I'm doing this now. All right. That's our next verse. All right. Before we see this next verse, let's have a brief introduction to set the context. Remember that Shankaracharya spent quite a bit of time considering the question, who is it that travels? Who reincarnates? Body, mind, senses, consciousness, ego, some combination of the above. And he takes the option. Remember those multiple choice tests. E was always none of the above. And that is exactly what Shankara concluded. No one travels. No one travels. We saw that. No one travels. The existence of an individual being who travels due to karma is a result of ignorance, like the rope snake. Rope snake, do you experience a rope snake? Sure you do. That's why you get frightened. Is it real? No. Does rope snake reincarnate? I'm silly to put it in those terms, but you get the point. And what's so significant here is this is where Advaita Vedanta really shows its greatness. Notice by refuting the existence, let me say, refuting the reality of a transmigrating entity, it simultaneously refutes the reality of the entire doctrine of karma. Gone! This is the highest teaching of Advaita Vedanta. What is one all-pervasive consciousness, which is identical to the substratum of reality. That's it. Anything else is... Where's my... There it is. Oh, it was there. Oh, it's moved around. All right. On its own? It grows feet and walks. So, here, everything else is nama-rupa, like the shape and form and color of the pot. The reality is clay. So the reality of you, me, and everything else, the reality is one, all-pervasive consciousness, which happens to be the substratum of reality, Brahman. Prajnanam Brahma, one of the Mahavakyas. So, that's a powerful place to begin our discussion today. So to look at this issue of who travels from the lofty perspective of non-duality. Obviously, no one can, if from the standpoint of non-duality, how can there be anyone who travels? Ultimately, the individual jiva who travels has to be resolved, has to be dismissed logically, has to be shown to be the product of ignorance. Only then, only when we negate the reality of the transmigrating entity, only then can we arrive at the vision of non-duality, and that indeed is the vision of the ancient rishis. So if we want to recognize what they recognized, we have to follow in their footsteps and be ready to give up all of our conclusions born of ignorance. The conclusion that there is a transmigrating entity is a wrong conclusion born of ignorance. The conclusion that you are an individual person who does things, who incurs karma, and those karmas accumulate, leading to birth after birth after birth, all of that is a projection due to ignorance. When you remove the ignorance, all of that goes away. Just like when you remove ignorance of the rope, what happens to the snake? That's it. You remove ignorance of the rope, what snake? You remove ignorance of the reality of who you are, what transmigrating entity can you possibly speak of? This is the power of ignorance. And arguably, there's nothing more powerful in the universe than ignorance. After all, suppose you were a scientist in a laboratory 100 years from now, and your assignment is to take an ordinary piece of rope and turn it into a snake. Even if you're a skilled scientist in the future with all modern technology at your hands, how will you turn that ordinary rope into a snake? Yet, a little bit of ignorance is all it takes, illustrating the power of ignorance. Okay, this is our introduction, and now we'll pick up the thread. Samsaro vastu sansteśam, samsaro vastu sansteśam, kartra bhoktrattva lakshanah, kartra bhoktrattva lakshanah, atma bhasa shraya jnanat, atma bhasa shraya jnanat, samsarantya vivekatah, samsaranta vivekatah. Samsaraha vastu san tesham. Tesham, for those ignorant people, for them, Shankara doesn't say ignorant. I'm adding that. Why? Because Shankara says, for them, samsaraha vastu san. They consider samsara to be vastu, to be real. Those who consider the transmigrating entity to be real, and when we say real as consciousness, as real as your essential nature, as real as the fundamental substratum because of which everything exists, absolutely real. Those who consider that transmigrating entity to be absolutely real, why do they consider that transmigrating entity to be absolutely real? Because in the third line, atma, abhasa, ashraya, ajnanat. This kind of captures our earlier discussion based on that pratibimbavara from our prior classes, the reflection metaphor. I've seen many times it's called reflection theory. Not a theory. A theory represents the thing. This is a metaphor. To call it a theory, you're giving it more reality than it deserves. It's not reflection theory. It is reflection metaphor. As I said, nothing gets reflected in your brain and mind are not shiny like a mirror. If you look inside of a neuroscientist, is not going to find anything shiny that reflects. This is, as we've said in several classes, don't take it as being real. It is a metaphor. The value of the metaphor is to help us explain what we experience. And to the extent that the metaphor helps us understand our experience, that's its value, not in explaining what's really happening. You don't need to explain what's really happening. Your experience is good enough. Your experience is self-sufficient. You experience what you experience. Do you need a theory to explain your experience? You don't need a theory. On the other hand, a metaphor might be helpful to understand how your experience takes place. This is a little subtle point, and I think very few people have considered it from this standpoint. The difference between theory and metaphor, I don't think I've ever talked about it in my class. So consider this, the difference between a theory and a metaphor. A theory attempts to describe what is. Attempts. That's why they call it a theory. If it really explained what is, it wouldn't call it a theory. So a theory is an attempted explanation of what is. Why do we need a theory to explain what you're experiencing right now? You don't need a theory. Your experience reveals itself. So what we do want to explore, however, is how does it happen? And that's where a metaphor is helpful. And that's why this pratibimbavada, this metaphor based on the mirror reflecting your face, is like consciousness reflecting the activities of your mind that are reflecting you as an individual being. The ahankara, this is our helpful metaphor. So here it's referred to in this third line, atma, consciousness, abhasa, the reflection of consciousness in your mind, and ashraya, the substratum or basis, the locus of that reflection. So the locus of the reflection in the metaphor is a mirror. The locus of the reflection in the real world is your mind. Just as the mirror reflects your face, your mind reflects consciousness. And just as a reflected face is not a real face, reflected consciousness is not your true nature. Reflected consciousness is what you're experiencing right now. It's not real. Remember our definition, unchanging. And our experience is constantly changing. Your experience can be clouded by fear, sadness, suffering, all of this stuff. But none of that belongs to consciousness. You can see the consequences and implications of this powerful teaching. So anyway, let's continue here. Ajnanat, due to ignorance about the difference between atma, consciousness, abhasa, the reflection of consciousness in your mind, and ashraya, the mind in which consciousness is reflected, because of your inability to discern what is what, because of your inability to discern the difference between rope and snake, you experience fear. Because of your inability to discern the difference between consciousness, its reflection, and mind, you experience suffering. Now, he goes a little deeper, and we've used these terms before. This individual who is said to transmigrate, who is the product of ignorance, is, according to Shankara, kartra bhoktritva lakshanaha. Lakshanaha characterized by kartritva and bhoktritva. A lot of Sanskrit syllables. Karta is the agent of action. Kartritva is agency. Bhoktritva is the status of being an experiencer. Bhokta, let me stay on line. Bhokta is the experiencer. Bhoktritva is the state of being the experiencer. So you look at yourself, fancy language, but important. These are important technical terms. You look at yourself as an agent of action and as bhokta. Usually, and a good meaning of bhokta is experiencer. By the way, it gets too often literally translated as enjoyer, which is fine if you want to be literal, but tell me, do you enjoy suffering? You experience suffering. You don't enjoy suffering. So to translate bhoktritva or to experience bhokta as enjoyer, I think is a lame translation. Experiencer is better. So we have a karta, a doer of action, and a bhokta, an experiencer of whatever is happening in life. But now, our context is talking about reincarnation, right? That's what we've been talking about for several classes now. In that context, according to the doctrine of karma, karta is the one who does karma, punya or papa. And whoever does punya papa should get some good result, and whoever does papa karma should get some undesirable result. So karta is the agent of action. That is no problem. Bhokta, then, is the one who reaps the karma. So bhokta creates the karma. I'm sorry, wrong one. Karta is the creator. Karta produces the karma pala, and bhokta reaps the results. So they're very deeply embedded in the doctrine of karma. But what happens when you discover karta is a product of ignorance? Now, what that means is when you say, I did it, did consciousness do something? Did mind do something independently of consciousness? Then how did it get done? Well, we say that it's this, due to this reflection and the interaction of consciousness and mind, blah, 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 we invent all of these reasons. It's like making up an excuse, right? The mom comes home and sees a broken lamp, and the kid says, I didn't do it, and then makes it, then how did it happen? Then the kid has to make up excuses how it happened. Oh, the cat knocked it over. Oh, if they live in California, there was an earthquake. So we make up reasons. That's basically what we do. We invent reasons to claim that we are an agent of action. And here's, according to the doctrine of karma, if you are truly the agent of action, you are absolutely going to get reborn because someone has to reap the results. That's it. Suppose you're not the agent of action. Suppose actions take place. No one can deny it. From a worldly level, actions take place. How? I was going to discuss this in the last line, but let's discuss it now. How do actions take place if consciousness alone exists? So from the highest standpoint, actions don't take place. at the level of Advaita. Now we have to drop down a level and talk about this worldly experience. So if we understand, that actions don't truly take place, it's like saying this pot doesn't truly exist, but we can still talk about it. It's nama-rupa. Do you perceive nama-rupa? Of course. So just because we say the pot isn't real doesn't mean we can't explain what it does, how it looks, and what happens to it. So we talk about it recognizing that it's not an absolute reality. It's not as real as clay. In the same way, we can talk about action recognizing it's not an absolute reality. If we want to understand the world, we have to understand the world at its own level. So we make this important differentiation between paramarthika satta, absolute reality, and vyavaharika satta, empirical reality. And we can talk about one or the other, no problem, just don't mix them up. That's where we get confused. So at this worldly level, if there's no karta, and by the way, here we have to say, for an enlightened person, there is no karta. Then how do actions take place? If an enlightened person is doing, I need to make this less abstract. Suppose I could say, I am not teaching. I can't say that. Absolutely, I can say that because I am consciousness. Does consciousness teach? No. I am consciousness. Therefore, I am not teaching. Teaching takes place, however, which is, hopefully, it's a good thing. Why does teaching take place? Well, there's a body with a mouth and tongue and a brain and a mind, and all of this stuff is functioning. Teaching takes place for two reasons. One is you're sitting here, and the other is the natural function of this body-mind-sense complex. What did consciousness do? When you sit down in front of this body-mind-sense complex, teaching takes place. Wouldn't that be kind of odd if it didn't, right? If you sat here and I just sat here, it would be very strange. But you sit here, this body-mind-sense complex is sitting here, teaching takes place. Why? It's natural. Isn't that how simple? It is. Of course teaching takes place. It's natural. From going back to the doctrine of karma, just for fun, since our topic is, in fact, the doctrine of karma with regard to reincarnation, why are you sitting here? Karma. Karma could be partially your past karma, which gave you an inclination for Vedanta, and then your current karma, which was getting in the car and driving here. So because of your karma, you're sitting here. And because of my prarabdha karma, or the prarabdha karma attached to the one called Swami Tadatmananda, because of that karma, teaching takes place. So this is an alternate explanation according to the doctrine of karma. Why is teaching taking, if consciousness doesn't teach, why does it take place? Two reasons. Your karma, you're sitting here, and Swami Tadatmananda's karma, prarabdha karma, according to the doctrine of karma, teaching takes place. What does consciousness do? You would say, kuch nahi, nothing at all. So this is what Shankara is teaching here, a very profound teaching. This is one step shy of the absolute teaching of Advaita. So this is quite lofty. And then he concludes, samsaranti avivekataha. Samsaranti, those poor, ignorant people. Samsaranti, they go from life to life to life. Or as my guru says, that's too optimistic. They go from death to death to death. Why? Avivekataha, driven by their ignorance, driven by their lack of discernment, driven by let's connect it to our prior discussion. Driven by the fact that they take themselves to be an agent of action. If you are an agent of action, you have to stick around in this life or future lives to reap the results. So look at the sequence we have here. Due to ignorance, you become an agent of action. I just demonstrated, by the way, how teaching can take place in the absence of an agent of action. So clearly, being an agent of action is a product of ignorance. An enlightened person says, action takes place, but I, as unchanging consciousness, don't do a thing. This is the vision of an enlightened person. On the other hand, in the presence of consciousness, these two important factors arise. Karta, I did it, agent of action. And bhokta, from two standpoints, you are the experiencer of what's happening now, but from this more karmic perspective, if you are the agent of action, you will certainly be the one to reap the results. And in this way, Shankara says, reincarnation is a product of ignorance. Just to summarize this whole discussion, if reincarnation is a product of ignorance, it's as real as that snake. But notice how, in conventional Hindu culture and even among serious students of Vedanta, there's so much emphasis put on this doctrine of creation, of this doctrine of reincarnation, doctrine of karma. Is it really warranted? When we have our question-answer sessions, as much as one-third, as many as one-third, as many as one-half of the questions that we get during our question-answer sessions, one-half of them are usually related in one way or the other to the doctrine of karma. Tell me, is it possible that it's misplaced effort? Misplaced focus? Misplaced attention? It's like you see the snake in the alley. What kind of snake is it? Right? There are different kinds of snakes, and is it poisonous? Is it not poisonous? Is it this kind of snake? I know nothing about snakes. So what kind of, who cares? It's not there. So this, to be honest, this is how I look at reincarnation. If you ask me, does reincarnation, the question usually comes, Swamiji, do you believe in reincarnation? Do you really believe in that snake? Really? That's what it comes down to. Okay, let's continue. Na buddhir hava bodhosti, na buddhir hava bodhosti, natmano vidyate kriya, natmano vidyate kriya, atho nanyatarasyapi, atho nanyatarasyapi, janati ticharyujyate, janati ticharyujyate. Suppose you're thinking, well, remember in our prior classes, Shankara had gone into all kinds of different possibilities of who is it that transmigrates, who is that jiva who gets reborn. Now, in this prior verse we ruled out karta and bhokta, some of you might be thinking about jñāta, the knower. By the way, jñāta. Let's just stay with that word. Jñāta, knower. I know what's happening right now. I know what's happening inside my mind. I know what's happening outside. And you could maybe, it's a weak argument to say the jñāta, the knower, is different than the karta and the bhokta. You can make that argument, but I would not. Because to be a knower, to know, is to know a verb or not. To know happens to be a verb. Don't verbs express action? So then you could say that jñāta is indeed a karta, an agent of action. And when you say, no, I know what's happening right now, doesn't that express an experience? Isn't that what being a bhokta is all about? So generally, jñāta gets kind of handled when we discuss karta and bhokta. But suppose someone is a little insistent. Let's understand this jñāta independently of karta and bhokta. Shankara says, fine, we'll consider it independently. And he says, what is that karta? What is that? Is there, if there's no karta and bhokta who can transmigrate, maybe there's a jñāta, a knower, who can transmigrate. But Shankara is going to show right now that just as the karta and bhokta are as real as a snake, so too the jñāta as real as a snake. And here's his argument. He says, na buddhehe avabodaha asti. Buddhehe, for the mind. Na avabodaha asti. There's no consciousness. Your mind can't know anything. Your mind is a product of brain. Brain is a physical thing. Mind is a non-physical thing. In the absence of consciousness, your brain is just a physical thing. In the absence of consciousness, your mind is a non-physical thing. Stuff. Brain is made of stula atoms. Mind is made of sukshma, subtle, non-physical stuff. So the mind is not a knower because it doesn't in and of itself possess consciousness. It requires consciousness to function. The mind in and of itself is an inert thing. And then on the other hand, Atman, in the second line, Atmanaha, for Atma, for consciousness, na vidyate kriya. There's no action. As we've said so many times, consciousness doesn't do anything. Consciousness is. Because consciousness is, thoughts take place. Because clay is, this pot exists. Because consciousness is, mental activities take place. But this pot is not real relative to the clay, in the same way thoughts are not real relative to consciousness. This is our understanding of that fundamental reality. So consciousness doesn't do anything. And as we've already observed, to know is, in Sanskrit, they're called kriyapadas, verbs. That a word that indicates action, but consciousness can't do anything. Ataha, Shankara concludes, na anyatarasya, for neither of them, not for the mind and not for consciousness, janati iti, the verb to know, na yujyate, cannot be used. You can't say to, you can't use the verb know with regard to the mind, nor for consciousness. Mind can't know anything. without consciousness. Consciousness can't know anything without mind. Simple. Mind can't know anything with consciousness. Consciousness can't know anything without mind. Then where is the knower? When you combine consciousness and mind, which don't really combine, this is an explanation. Did pot get combined with clay? It's really not a combination. You combine two similar things, right? You can combine two lumps of clay. You can put a small pot inside a big pot. How's that? So you can combine similar things. How do you combine nama-rupa with clay? It's not, the word combine is not correct here. And I'm pointing that out. And I'm actually correcting myself because I used that word. You cannot combine mind and consciousness. And let me make that point. This is where I started. I said, when you combine mind and consciousness, I caught myself. Why? You can't combine mind and consciousness any more than you can combine nama-rupa and clay. As I said, two lumps of clay? Fine. Two pots? Fine. But nama-rupa and clay are two different kinds of reality. One is more real than the other. It's like trying to... This is a waking state pot. Can I fill it with dream water? Can I combine? Can I fill it with dream water? Or vice versa. If you're in a dream and you have some water, can you pour it into this pot? You see, in order for there to be any combination, and I apologize, this is a rather heavy philosophical topic, but I think you get the importance of it. You can only combine things of a similar order of reality. Okay, enough said. So, you can't combine mind and consciousness to create a knower. This is a point. You put in the kitchen, you use these mixies. So you put in some mind, you put in, I'm being absolutely silly. Yeah, but it makes a point. They're not two different things that can be combined because they don't enjoy the same level of reality. Therefore, how do you explain the knower? Jñāta. It's as real as a snake. We're right back to Shankara's point. It's a product of ignorance. If the knower doesn't belong to the mind, and the knower doesn't this is the logic. Look at this. And by the way, one reason, that this is a little bit of an aside to explain why I'm dwelling so much on this logic. If this logic weren't solid, we wouldn't be studying this today because it would have been picked apart centuries ago. Because this logic is so rigorous, this stands the test of time. Lots of doctrines haven't stood the test of time, even in science. So 200 years ago, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, they had this idea of ether. Scientists developed this idea of ether because they couldn't explain how electromagnetic waves traveled through space. Waves can only travel through a medium, therefore they invented the idea of ether. Didn't hold up very well. In fact, probably that idea lasted about 50 years or so. You can go back and study the history of science and find out it was a very short-lived idea. My point being, anything that's not rigorously established in logic will sooner or later get dismissed. this is so solid in its logic. And let me give you to it very briefly, and then we'll move on. So here's the logic. Can there exist a knower who transmigrates? This is the question. So first we say, well, who is where is that knower? Is the knower the mind? No. Because the mind is not a conscious thing. Is the knower consciousness? No, because consciousness doesn't do anything. Then the last option is, is the knower the combination of consciousness and mind? No, because you can't put them in the mixie. Look at how solid that logic is. Knower doesn't belong to the mind. Knower doesn't belong to the consciousness. Knower doesn't belong to the combination of the two. By the way, in Buddhist logic, there's one more option. So it's A or B. A or B. Neither A nor B. In Buddhist logic. So I'm sorry, I'm boring you probably with this logic. So A means consciousness below, I'm sorry, knower is in the mind. Get rid of that, that's A. B, knower is in consciousness, get rid of that. C, the next option is A and B together. And we've just said you can't combine them in the mixie. They're two different levels of reality. In Buddhist logic, there's the fourth option. So A, B, A and B together, and the last option is neither A nor B. But notice Shankara doesn't bother with that. Buddhists may bother with that. We don't bother with that because in the absence of a mind and the absence of consciousness, how can you talk about a knower? That's the fourth option, which is not even considered by Shankara because it's just silly. Okay, so just a few moments of tangent to show how solid is the logical basis for these teachings. I think we'll just take one more verse today. Na ye sham heka he vatma, na ye sham heka he vatma, nirdukho vikriya sada, nirdukho vikriya sada. Tesham syat chapta vachyam tvam, tesham syat vachyam vachya tvam, nyeya tvam chatmana sada, nyeya tvam chatmana sada. And it summarizes the last two verses. From the standpoint of enlightenment, yesham, for those who get it, for those who get it, what? Atma ekaha eva. I'm just changing the order of the words. Those who know that atma is ekaha, one, and eva, only. Atma is the one and only reality at that level. So from the standpoint of clay, there's no pot. Notice we're not saying pot doesn't exist. We're saying from the standpoint of clay, there is only clay. From the standpoint of Atma, there is only Atma. Therefore, is Atma a karta, an agent of action? Atma doesn't do anything. Is Atma a bhokta, an experiencer? In order to be an experiencer, there has to be something to experience. But if Atma is ekaha and eva, if Atma is the one and only thing that exists, then there's no thing for Atma to know. There's only Atma. Again, we're getting this solid logic. We're seeing a lot of that in the verses today. So for those who know, Atma is ekaha eva, Atma is one and only from its own standpoint. Like in your dream, It's all mind stuff. There's nothing else in your dream. There's no dream elephant. From the standpoint of dream stuff, from the standpoint of the dreamer is consciousness. There is only dreamer consciousness. There's no dream elephant. There's no dream world, no dream sky. This is the perspective. So from the perspective of Atma, Atma ekaha, Atma is the one reality, eva, and there's no other reality. So for those who understand this profound truth, for them, sada, always, eternally, there is nirdukkaha, no suffering, and avikriyaha, no action. Take avikriyaha, no action, no change, because no karta. If there's no agent of action, how can there be any change? How can there, if there's no karta, there's no vikriya, there's nothing changing atma. Also, nirdukha, no suffering. So we said, if Atma is eka eva, Atma is the only reality, how can you, if Atma is the only reality, Atma is consciousness, how can, if consciousness is the only reality, how can consciousness experience suffering? To have an experience, you require, as a minimum, a conscious experiencer and an object of experience. So how can you experience suffering if Atma is eka eva? The one and only reality rules out the possibility of there being something called suffering that can be experienced. Remember now, this whole discussion is at the very lofty level. We're describing the vision of an enlightened person. The enlightened person says, for me, consciousness, there is no suffering. Then, tesham, for such enlightened people, na syat, that na, in the very first word, has to be dropped down to the verb syat. Na syat, for those enlightened people, na syat, there is nothing which is shabda vachyatvam, referring to Atma. You know, I have to make an excuse for myself, and that is, I chopped out quite a few verses before, which introduced a very complicated linguistic argument that Sri Shankara introduced. And like I said, we're trying to keep this a little simpler. We're also trying to keep it a little shorter than the 200 and some verses that are actually in this chapter. So I chopped out a lot of very technical words, a lot of technical verses about linguistics. But here Shankara, and maybe I should have chopped this one out, but there's some important stuff. He's talking about shabdavachyatvam based on his prior discussion about linguistics. And in linguistics, there's a very common question: do words really indicate objects? What is the relationship between the word pot and the thing I'm holding in my hand? If you ask a linguist that question, what is the relationship between pot and the object I'm holding in my hand, the linguist will give you a 1 hour lecture and then tell you, he'll end his 1 hour lecture and say, I'll tell you the rest tomorrow. In other words, it's complicated. linguistics from a philosophical standpoint is really complicated. But Shankara took some of that up, and I've kind of, we've skipped over those verses. But coming back to this verse, we can ask the question, not the relationship between this object and the word pot, but how about the relationship between the word bhokta, And can't say object, Atma. If this object can be called pot, can Atma be called karta or bhokta? Now, notice this pot is an object. Atma is not an object, but we're talking about linguistics here. So we can use the word pot to describe this. Can we use the words karta, agent of action, and bhokta, experiencer? Can we use these words to describe Atma? And based on what we last two, three verses, the two verses we've just seen, Atma is not a karta or bhokta. In fact, in the very last verse, we saw that Atma can't know anything. Atma can't know anything other than itself. Atma cannot be the agent of the action to know. Why? Atma can't do anything. Atma can't experience anything and be a bhokta. Why? There's nothing else for Atma to experience. So Atma, I'm just recapping the prior verse. Atma cannot be a karta, an agent of action, nor a bhokta, an experiencer of something other than itself. Therefore, Shankara kind of returns to his earlier linguistic argument and says, therefore, Atma cannot be described by words like karta and bhokta. So this would be a more profound statement if we had studied all those verses on linguistics. But anyway, you get the point. You cannot call Atma a karta or a bhokta. And he adds one more thing at the end. Nyeya tumcha atmanaha. Nor can you say Atma, Atmanaha, for Atma, nor can you say Atma is an object of knowledge, that which is known. Atma is not an agent. Let's just do the negation. This is, we're back to our 1880. Consciousness as a fundamental reality. Consciousness is not an agent of action because it's unchanging. Atma is not an experiencer because there's nothing other than Atma to be experienced. Atma is not a knower for the same two reasons. And finally, Atma is not an object known or experienced for all the same reasons. What's left? This is negation. This is the power of negation. We've reached the end of the road through negation. There's nothing left to negate. If Atma is not an object known, that negates what? Everything. Everything other than you. So to say object, Atma is not an object known, which is what he says in the last line, that's the biggest part of the negation, includes your body and mind and thoughts and emotions and everything else. So that is all negated in one fell swoop. Then we have the last few. Well, I seem to be an agent of action. So I'm not the body, mind, senses, thoughts, emotions, blah, 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 blah. Then what am I? I'm an agent of action. Nope. I am an experiencer of stuff. Nope. I am a knower. Nope. What's left? In English, we tend to use this word pure consciousness for this reason. Consciousness as such. And he says, Atma eva, Atma ekaha eva. This is, those two little words are so important. There is ekaha Atma, there is one Atma, one consciousness, eva, only, and there's nothing else. And that consciousness is the fundamental reality that is your fundamental reality. The consciousness by which you know what's happening right now, if you strip off all your wrong conclusions, the consciousness that's present in your experience right now is that consciousness, which is eka, one, and eva, only. This is, I think, one of our most profound classes. Just the level at which Shankara is teaching here is almost startling. Stark, it's just bang in your face. Okay, this is a good place to conclude today. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityorma amritangamaya. Om shanti shanti shantihi. Om tat sat. All right.